please dial star 611 for assistance.
We get signal, main screen turn on. You're listening to the radio program about Hacker Spaces. This here little radio program about Hacker Spaces.
Welcome to TalkingAnthropology.com from SignalHackerspaces.org. Today's episode is about social engineering. My guest is Chris Logan from the USA, and you will hear now an edited version of the interview we had on the 21st of March, but you can go to TalkingAnthropology.com to hear the full-length interview, as well as you can comment there on my site and drop me a line of feedback. Okay, I hope you enjoyed today's show, and hear you soon. Good. Then I welcome you to the show, Logan. One can find you at Human Hacker on Twitter, and you are part of the Social Engineer podcast and also the Offensive Security team.
Yes.
And you just recently wrote a book, Social Engineering, The Art of Human Hacking. And this is the subject we're going to talk about. So maybe you want to introduce yourself, give some background about you.
Sure. Well, you kind of brought up all the important details. I work as the operations manager for offensive security. We do penetration testing, mostly black box penetration testing, as well as security training in the field, penetration testing training. Mostly live courses done in America and some other places in Europe, as well as online training for different varying levels of security. Training from exploit development to regular penetration testing, wireless attacks, things like that. And on the side, I do a lot of work with social-engineer.org. I've kind of helped one of the main developers and creators of that site, where we have the first, what we think is at least what we can find, the first web-based framework, kind of like the penetration testing framework for social engineering, that outlines and dissects what social engineering is and how it's performed and the different aspects from it, physically, psychologically, mentally, all those types of things. So the book kind of takes after that. It's it was designed really after the framework of that was produced on the social-engineer.org site. So those are really the two main things that we do right now. Our podcast, we cover topics that normally aren't security based. We interview people like radio hosts, psychologists, doctors, persuasion experts, and then we try to figure out what they do in their business and their life that we can learn from as social engineers, and then try to dissect their talents to bring it about what we can learn from them.
We'll go into the subject of social engineering later and explain what it is, but can you give a brief introduction into security testing and penetration testing for the audience of TalkingAnthropology.com?
Sure, yeah, not a problem with that. Well, sometimes, well, not sometimes, as a matter of fact, lately, if you read the news at all, there seems to be day after day another attack on companies being released with the groups like Anonymous, what happened with RSA, HB Gary, those things are just endless, where a company has been hacked and attacked by hackers, either using social engineering or just straight out hacking methods to infiltrate their data. So companies that are interested in securing their data will hire companies like ours to perform those same attacks against their company. But we don't do it with malicious intent. We do it to find the holes and the vulnerabilities, and then we report back to the company how we got in, and then that company is able to fix any problems or gaps that existed so that way they can not be attacked by the malicious guys.
And I think it's basically the same principle and ideology behind penetration testing, which is also behind social engineering, or...
Yes, I think so. You know, if you're talking about audits, it's the same whether you're doing a pen test or social engineering. We use all the methodologies that the bad guys use. The only thing that really is different is our intent. You know, when we get a juicy piece of information, or when we hack a company or get data, we don't sell it on the black market or use it to blackmail them or something to that effect. We report it back to the company so that way they can fix it. And we involve training in that. We feel that, like our motto on socialengineer.org is security through education. So we feel that really the best way to, for people to remain secure is to be educated about how these attacks are being performed, so that way they can maintain some kind of security against those attacks.
And could you give us some brief explanation about what now specifically means social engineering? Which kinds of techniques do you use? What do you do in your work when you are hired by a company?
Sure. We define social engineering as the act of influencing someone to take an action that may or may not be in their best interest. And we use that very specific definition because we feel that social engineering is used many times in fields that are not security related, like a psychologist or a doctor. You go to a doctor and you have a health problem and they're going to convince you to take some medication or to reduce your diet or change your habits. And many times these things are done through persuasion. You know, if a doctor is persuasive and good, they can convince you to take these actions that you might not normally take, but it's in your best interest. We think that that is a form of social engineering. But on the same side, a different side of the coin, people use social engineering also to build rapport, like salespeople do that. So they build a rapport with someone on the phone or in person, and they're able to then build a relationship that will convince that person that buying from them or taking an action with that person is the best case scenario for them. Social engineers use those same principles. Building friendships, building rapport with people that allows them to either gain access to a building or to over the phone to gain access to information. And sometimes that information might seem innocuous, not dangerous, not like they call up and say, "What's your password?" But they'll call up and ask for things like who handles your dumpster removal or your garbage removal, things like that. And they'll get this information and use it in attacks. I think that's two parts of your question. There was another part, which is what we do.
Mm-hmm.
So for us, when we get hired by a company to do audits, we'll employ all the techniques that we can, whatever's allowed by the audit report or whatever we're allowed to do basically for the audit, and whatever fits. You know, I mean, if we get hired by a company overseas, there's a good chance, unless there's a lot of on-site, you know, we'll use more phone and or email attacks. If it's something that we're going to be in person at, then we'll use in-person attacks. You know, there are limitations, I think, when you're a professional social engineer. You know, some of the things that we avoid that are used often in the corporate world, like we won't use someone's kids against them or, you know, attack their family in order to infiltrate their business or something to that effect. You know, there are limits to things that we'll do, I guess, on a moral level.
Yeah, I would like to go into the moral level later if we come to it.
Sure.
But when we look at classical penetration testing in a technical framework, then I think this whole topic evolved when security awareness started off in the 90s, or I don't know where you would put the start, but this was a kind of new idea that there are attackers out there and we have to make systems secure, and that probably is a big task for the economy or for the government. But this whole social engineering thing is much younger. Although it is based on many classical rhetorical things or things like NLP, and I would like to go now in the history of it. You know, when did the social engineering thing took off, really?
Well, I tell you, I don't know. You can go way back in human history and find accounts of social engineering. You know, you can go back in human record, you know, as far back as like even in the Bible and find accounts of where people used classical methods of social engineering. But I mean, let's say in recent history, in the last couple hundred years, you can go back and find people who've social engineered. There was a guy who convinced people to buy the Brooklyn Bridge in New York. He convinced people to buy the Eiffel Tower. He actually convinced those that he owned these items, that he owned these pieces of architecture, and then sold them and had people actually buy them from him. That was a classic con men and social engineers back in the day. Scam artists tend to be quite prolific throughout history, so we see a lot of those things. I think in the recent years we see things like Mark Rifkin. If you heard maybe about that name, Mark was a guy who worked for as a tech company. He worked with a tech company doing computer repairs, and one of his clients was a large bank. And he was able to infiltrate the bank. This was in the 70s now, performing one of the biggest bank heists in history and never having used a gun. There was an article about it in Time magazine. We wrote about it on the framework, and I even mentioned it in my book briefly, that in the 70s he was able to basically, just using rapport, building friendships with people, gaining access to areas of the bank that he was not allowed to gain, and was able to access codes that were written on the wall, basically, that he used those codes to call up different parts of the bank and make believe he was someone he wasn't, and had money transferred to an account that was his outside of the bank. And he stole tens of millions of dollars doing that, and then was able to actually convince black market diamond thieves that he was like a Russian diamond dealer, and was selling or buying diamonds to transfer that money into something more solid, and then was going to resell those diamonds, so he had now cash that was not traceable. A real genius the guy was, and he almost got away with it. He got caught in the end, but then he was released from prison for a little while and went right back and tried to do the same thing again. Now, this is in the 70s, so you know, we can go back really pretty far in history, and even in recent history, and see accounts where social engineering has been used to con people out of money and companies out of large sums of money.
Mm-hmm. I mean, to pretend to be someone else or to do something different than reality is a quite narrative thing, which probably everyone is doing. But I see here this classical hacker approach that you look at the system and you look at the holes. You look at the not classical use cases, and to get to other paths which usually wouldn't be accessible to you. And when you look at the classical hacker, you normally wouldn't see them in a common sense as a specifically socially skilled person. But as a matter of fact, you have now social engineering in most of the hacker conferences, or at least the security-focused conferences. So when did you trace in your book the beginning of the social engineer idea in the hacker scene?
Wow, that's a good question. I don't know if I can actually honestly answer that. I mean, you know, let's say if you wanted to use one of the most widely known hacker conferences like DEF CON, I believe it was DEF CON 3 or so when there was the first social engineering. They attempted a social engineering contest. So if we're on DEF CON 19 now, we're looking at 16 years ago. But I'm sure that maybe in HOPE or times before that there was social engineering. You're looking at people like Kevin Mitnick, who made it popular.
Yes, yeah.
You know, we're going back now 20-plus years with him. You know, it's hard to say like when it actually became popular in the security space. I think there probably always was some interest in social engineering to an extent in the security space. Maybe just not as popular. I know for a while, maybe even now, there's still some of this, that some people view social engineering as not really part of security or hacking. They view it kind of like as a lesser form, you know, just talking to people and then you get information, whereas hacking is the real skill. But I think that also there's another movement, you know, where a lot of hackers realize that they're not socially adept, so it's harder for them to think about social engineering. You know, that kind of goes by the wayside now with social media. Social media makes it a little easier, I think, to manipulate someone over the internet using communication methods without having to interact with people as much.
Yeah, Exactly. I mean, now everyone is wired into Facebook, and there you have a way to interact with people on a simply a text-based method. You do not even have to take up a phone to get in contact to some employee of a firm, for example.
Yeah, you can build whole profiles off of companies or just individuals based on their social media. And we have people who use Facebook and LinkedIn and Twitter and Foursquare, and you know, just using, let's say, those handful of social media sites that are very popular, you can build a profile off someone. You can go in their LinkedIn and see what their last two or three jobs were, you know, where they live. Go to Facebook and see pictures of their friends, their vacations, their weekends. People tweet everything under the sun, and then they use Foursquare to check in on places. And then you take a tool like Creepy. This is a brand new tool that just mm-hmm. is coming out now that gathers all of their tweets and finds any tweet that has geolocation data, and then builds a Google map based off of that geolocation data. You know, these things are now becoming prolific, where it's just very easy to build a profile, even a physical profile on someone, knowing where they are and where they go and where they eat and what they do, based off and never having to meet the person, not having to stalk them or follow them, but just following them on the internet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's also here in Europe, politically a very hot subject is potential risks, but also the positive possibilities out of this new technology we have in our society. And I think tools like Creepy really show how much is possible right now already. And we don't have to go into a near future to have complete profiling of people. It's already possible if you use social media.
Yeah, I agree. Very possible, and it's being done. And then you take into consideration also smartphones. You know, there's a lot of smartphones out there that when you take a picture with it, that they embed GPS location data inside the picture. So now these people tweet pick things about themselves or their family or their jobs or their friends, and the next thing you know is if you just pull that photo down and use something like FX to pull out the GPS data, you know, game over. You can find out exactly where they live or where they work or other things like that.
Mm. I think it's important to point out here that it may be hackers who show the potentials of this technology, but they were probably used long before that, long before Creepy came along, because that's what usually secret agents are doing to get in contact with people and trying to get information on an informal way, or intelligence agencies which try to gather information in all possible ways. So what the hackers are doing here is basically just making things visible that probably would have been done otherwise as well.
Yeah, I think that's 100% true. I think tools like Creepy, all they've done is make this kind of job easier. Not necessarily that they've taken out the manual aspect of it and made it automatic. So now anyone can do what we just talked about. Anybody can download that and input a person's name and find their Twitter ID and geolocate them. Whereas before, you had to know something. You had to know how to grab the pictures and how to put them through the program and how to find the GPS data, and you had to know all that. Now it's done automatically with software. So I agree. These things are probably being done for a lot longer by governments, too, than we even know.
Mm. And now we come to an interesting point, because usually when it comes to hackers or penetration testing, and the classical scenario is always that hackers find a hole and then they disclose it and want it to get fixed. But when it comes to social problems or just behaviors we developed in our society, the fixing is much more difficult. Because it actually includes changing behavior or changing perceptions. Maybe you can go into that when it comes to the education part of your work.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point, is that in the social engineering aspect, the reason it's so hard and the reason we see the same, I mean, in essence, maybe the technology's changed, but the the principles have not, and how people are being conned or scammed or socially engineered. And because there's one factor that hasn't changed, and that's people trust people. And inherently, people want to help other people. So because of that, a simple statement, you know, you walk up to the secretary in the front desk and, hey, maybe you can help me. And something like that just opens somebody up to now their mindset is, I'm going to help you. And although there, you know, there inherently maybe people are a little less trustful of others as they were in the past, the human nature is still there, where the desire to help others is inherent, and that's what's exploited by people often. And also the belief factor that people are inherently honest. That's something that's exploited by social engineers every day. People take you for your word at face value. Often, every day, you can just tell people things, and then they're not going to doubt you or double guess you. For the most part, you know, if something is believable by face, you know, I mean, if I tell you that if I'm standing in front of you and I tell you I'm a female, you're probably not going to believe me. But you know, if I try to convince you that you know, 20 instead of 25 or whatever, I could probably convince you of that with very little effort. And someone's not going to distrust me. So that is exploited by social engineers every day. And I think that's part of the problem. That's hard to train. So to help fix that, what companies need to do or what people need to do is to become more aware of the information that they release and how it's released. Because doing that could protect you to an extent. You know, to say don't use Twitter or don't use Facebook, don't use Foursquare, that's silly because people are not going to not do that. They're going to use those things. But what kind of information do you need to put on there? You know, we did this one newsletter where we just picked a random person. There was a website that was very popular just a year ago or so called Blippi. And I don't know why anyone would do this, but this website allows you to tie your bank accounts into this website, and every time you purchase something, it in essence tweets the purchase. Yeah, amazing, isn't it? Like this is totally amazing. Blippi, B-L-I-P-P-Y, was the service. So now you have thousands of people that were signing up for the service. Every time they bought something with a credit card or a check, it said, you know, Chris has bought something at Starbucks for $7.08. You know, Chris went to Barnes & Noble's and bought books for $14.50. And you can go and follow somebody and basically develop a profile, a pattern of where they shop, how much they spend, what they bought. I mean, think about the security implications of that. You know that a person every day at 7 a.m. they're at Starbucks buying coffee, and you know how much they spend. I mean, that allows you a massive opportunity for social engineering. You know what location of Starbucks, how much they spent, and what time, and how often they spend it. You know, convincing someone I'm from your credit card company has just become easier because now I have your purchasing history. Hey, this is Chris. I'm from, you know, your Visa account. I just have a couple questions on some charges that you have here. You know, is this the card ending in 7824? You know, and how many people are not going to believe you because I have your account record?
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah, and it's also perfectly possible then to see when someone changes his behavior. You haven't bought your coffee at Starbucks, so you probably didn't went to office on this day.
There you go.
Maybe you were ill, or maybe something else happened.
There you go. And then you check their Facebook, and you find that, guess what? They're on vacation. Now, this has happened. This is in the news here in America, at least. A couple thieves were stalking people using Facebook and Twitter, finding out when they weren't at work, when they left, and then they were going to their home and stealing. Now, this one family went away for 3 weeks, and this group of thieves went to their house with a moving van, dressed up as moving people, and the neighbors just thought that they were having stuff stored. So these people systematically went in every day and piece by piece emptied their home. And when the family came home from vacation, they came home to an empty house, literally an empty house. Amazing stories you hear this because of social media.
That's stunning. Yeah. I mean, And on the one hand, we now have the example you just gave us is one where usually would think everyone should be aware of that, that there has to be a risk involved. But when it just comes to usual Twitter usage, or especially when you look at the media behavior of kids, the question is always how far should we go, and does everyone need to become paranoid to stay secure? Where do you draw the boundary line?
Yeah, that's a funny question, because actually, as a joke, we usually tell people that they're not paranoid enough. I mean, that's really it's funny that you worded it that way, because I think that would work, but you know, you don't want to promote the society of people walking around so paranoid that now they don't. You know, they've lost that thing that makes us human, which is just being trusting and enjoying contact with other people. I think that in these cases with social media, it's really thinking through how you release information. You know, do I need to tell you every time I've bought coffee at Starbucks? Do I need to tell you when I'm going on vacation? No, you know, heck, you announced it in the beginning of this. I have a Twitter account, and I use it. But, you know, I use it to release information about our website, about things that are happening in the news. I don't use it to tell the world my personal business. So I think if people were smarter about how they utilize social media, then it would become less, the world would be less inundated with these types of attacks. I think that people use social media to kind of have like a web-based diary almost that anyone can read. You know, think about the origin of blogs. If you just think back to maybe, I can't think of how long ago it was, maybe 4 or 5 years when blogs first started becoming very popular. Mm-hmm. They were basically online diaries. That's all they were. People came on and they talked about their day, and they talked about what they were doing for work and their life and their relationships and their ups and their downs, and it became a massive hit. People started reading about other people's lives. It was like this hidden thing. You know, you got beat up if you read your sister's diary, but now you can read them online. You know, they're all there. You know, anyone could read anyone's diary. And it became such a popular hit. It was like reality TV. I could peer into your life and know everything about you, and you're letting me do it. And I believe, honestly, that that's what kind of took off on social media. It was another way for people to let the whole world know what they're doing and how they're doing it. And everybody enjoys to, you know, be a voyeur almost. So that's, I think that's really how it worked out. And unfortunately, people haven't really sat down and thought. You know, when we were talking about Blippi before, we just pulled a random guy off the site and for a newsletter article. And we said, let's see what we can find out about him. And, you know, he happened to have Facebook, Twitter, Foursquare. I mean, literally within 15 minutes in the newsletter, we developed a social engineering report on this poor guy. He had tweeted that he was moving. He took an actual photo of the lease for his new apartment. He took a photo of his apartment building that had GPS data in it, told us the exact address of his new place. He took pictures of his electronics that he bought to put into his apartment. And this is the guy who also used Blippi to outline all of his purchases. It's like it's a thief's dream. You know, it's a social engineer's dream, these kinds of people that do this stuff. And, you know, you just wonder what is the motivation for telling the whole world all this. I think the really security is through education on that point. People need to realize what you're doing when you do this.
Yeah, to answer your question, as an anthropologist, I think it's the universal desire to share, to connect, not to feel lonely, to express ourselves in the most day-to-day way, just to create an image of ourselves, to have something that sustains when we vanish. And I think these impulses drive people to behave like this. And also, when you look at the time frame, these technologies are so brand new, and we are actually right now at the point where we start developing cultures for it, ways of relating to this new way of social interaction. And we definitely will see a shift in there. And maybe social engineering is one way of pointing out the possibilities this technology brings. I see this as a major function of the hacker thing itself, to look beyond the edge and try to translate what's going on in the potential unforeseen area for the common population.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that's a good statement too, because I'm a technology buff, so I love technology. But at the same time, I see where it's also ruined the ability for humans to interact. You know, I mean, if you think about children, you know, children nowadays, texting is so big. I think children have forgotten how to communicate with each other, just to have a normal conversation. I've heard, I don't know if it's the same in Europe, but in America, many schools are not even having writing classes anymore. You know, the old adage, reading, writing, and arithmetic. Well, writing has now been taken out because people type so much that they allow every report, everything to be typed. You don't have to write anymore with your hand. So what you have is these 17, 18, 19-year-olds that when they write, they look like they're 4 or 5. You know, they can't do cursive. They can't write with their own hand because everything's typed. The human interaction part that technology has allowed, it's made the world very small. You know, I can talk with people. I mean, look at you and I right now. I mean, we're in totally separate continents around the globe, but we're having a conversation as if we're sitting in the same room. Technology allows that to occur, which is a great thing. But at the same time, without responsible use of it, it also has diminished the ability for people to communicate and think intelligently, in my opinion, at least.
Yeah, maybe hit the turn here, and when we come back to social engineering, do you prefer targeting huge companies with hundreds or thousands of employees, or are the small companies with just a handful of people easier or more kind of interesting challenge?
I'll tell you the truth, that's a really good question. Last year at DEF CON 18, we got invited to run a contest for social engineering. And we if anyone's been to DEF CON that's listening to the podcast and they've seen the contest in the past, one of the things that we kind of pride ourselves on, because we do this for work, is that we never want to leave anyone feeling victimized. You know, that's the difference between a malicious and a non-malicious social engineer, in my opinion. If you leave someone feeling victimized, like the next day they wake up and they feel terrible, they're nervous, they're paranoid, in my opinion, you damage them. You didn't help them be more secure. You damage them psychologically, you damage their human infrastructure, and that doesn't really help anybody. So we tried to develop this contest with the idea of how can we run a contest on social engineering without damaging people's human infrastructure. And we figured that the best way to do that is to not name names, to call Fortune 500 companies that are huge, and to not ask for information that could be damaging to their business. So we you know, long story short, you can find the rest of the story on that on the web, but we called Fortune 500 companies. And I really honestly thought that the contest would lead me to believe that small companies were easier targets. But that is not the case today, in my opinion. Fortune 500 companies have such a massive space in the world and the internet that the attack target, the vectors, the holes that could potentially exist are so prolific that finding a door in is much easier in a large company than in a small company because of the amount of people that the companies have. I mean, you call a company, like one of our targets was a Ford Motor Company last year in the contest. And Ford, you know, 5,000, 10,000, 15,000 employees. You know, one area of their business has got like 5,000 people working there. You call that kind of a company, and even if you raise a massive red flag, it's going to be many hours or longer before that red flag spreads through the whole company. So your attack surface that you have for a company like that, and even if there's some degree of failure in the call, it's much easier than to succeed with a large company. And also, it's harder to control 5, 8, 10, 15,000 people. So you guarantee that out of that, there's going to be a group of people that are insecure, that don't take security seriously. That, you know, and that was proven too. One of the targets we had, I can't name the name for this one because I'm going to give you some details, but one of the targets we had last year, massive retail company, and the first 5 people we called shot us down. You know, we made 6 phone calls to this one company, and we called the first five, just completely obliterated us, hung up, knew that we were up to something no good, were able to read through the lines, and just did not give us any information. The sixth phone call, we found a person that not only was willing to give us information, but like gladly went to a manager's computer, turned it on, and gave us every piece of information we wanted from that computer. So in the same company, you know, so when you look at that, maybe it's a 5-to-1 ratio for security, but the company still failed because that one was able to give us all the information we wanted.
Yeah, and as bigger the company is, as more possibilities and shots you have.
Yeah, and with a small company, if you call a company with 10 or 20 or even 100 employees and you raise a red flag, that red flag is going to spread through that company very fast, and your ability to re-attack is going to be very limited on the same pretext and under the same vector because of failure with a small company, but not the same with a big company. So I have to say that for audits, I would much rather deal with a big company.
One question I would really like to ask you is, if one of our listeners would like to get into the subject of social engineering, could you point to any references, your book or things on the web, videos, or maybe classical actor training, which are helpful for the things you do?
Yeah, all of those things. The book, of course, is a commercial thing, so I'd love to promote that, but I understand that some people, some listeners, that if they're students, they might not have a lot of money. So if you can't buy the book, the website, the social-engineer.org, the framework that's there is just amazing. Really outlines, especially coming from an anthropology standpoint, I think, as you guys study human behavior, you study humans. We've attempted to do the same thing in a social engineering aspect, where we don't just look at it as security. We've analyzed the psychology of why people do the things they do, aspects of persuasion and influence, microexpressions, body language, vocal tone, all these things that make a person up and enable them to influence another person, what we've analyzed on the framework. And then we've taken that a step further with like our monthly newsletter, which is not commercial. It's completely free. That's a free resource. And our podcast, which is also free. Those things all promote the idea of learning about people from a security standpoint. Those things are great. Now, those are all ours. Now, if you wanted to take that out of let's say, the social engineering realm, there's some really great DVDs. You know, maybe I can email you some links because I don't have them off the top of my head. But
yes, we'll include them in the show notes. I will point to your book and all the things you give me. Also, the contest on DEF CON I will include.
Excellent.
When it comes to the theory, you know, you could go into the subject from various vectors. You could either go from just social intelligence, you know, what creates trust for yourself. You can watch your own behavior, which people you trust, and how has someone to look or to act to be a reliable person in your perception. But there are also other classical techniques. It comes down to Greek rhetorics. How do you have a good talk that you can convince people? But there are also things like NLP, neuro-linguistic programming, or NHR, neuro-hypnotic repatterning, which for me are also somehow connected to the subject.
I agree.
How do you see that? Are you using some of the techniques from these two aspects?
Yeah, I'm touchy with NLP, but I do believe in it. Actually, there's a whole section about it in the book and in the framework about NLP. I only say touchy because I'm not one of those guys that believes in hypnosis. And again, I don't want to start a debate on anything, you know, but that's just my feeling on it personally and from my experience. But that doesn't mean I don't believe in NLP or the patterns, like the other one you brought out, the NHR, the patterns that can be used to put someone, I should clarify that. It depends on how you define hypnosis. You know, like snapping your finger and I'm going to cluck like a chicken. I don't believe in that, but do I believe that using certain word patterns and vocal tones that you can influence me into a certain state of mind? Yes, I do believe that. And that's the part of NLP that I really do get into. I think that something that NLP has taught since the 60s and 70s when it was developed is the usage of words and your voice. I know a guy who just is so perfect at this. You know, when he wants to calm you down, he'll start talking in a lower tone and a softer tone in his voice, and he'll start using words that sound soft, so not words that sound so harsh. His whole inflection of his voice will change like this, and he'll talk in a way that just mellows you and soothes you. So if you're angry and you approach him in a very angry tone and he starts talking to you like this, it's not patronizing. He's not going to speak to you like you're a child, but his whole tone changes, and you find it very hard to be upset or angry about something when he's talking to you like that. And that's influence. That's using NLP to influence somebody. I find that to be very powerful, in my opinion. And the NHR aspect of the world, like repeating certain words that could have, for lack of better terms, like a hypnotic approach to you, like the word, certain sentences. I know that in NLP they call it, the power voice or something to that effect, where you match your breathing with the person you're speaking to, and then you use words, putting emphasis on certain words that you want the brain to pick up. You know, I think they promote this in sales a lot. Like, when you will buy a product like this from someone like me, what kind of features do you want? And you put the emphasis on the words, when you buy this product from me. So in that sentence, what the brain hears is a whole different thought. I'm sorry, what the ears hear is a whole different thought than what the brain hears. See, the ears hear you asking a question. When you buy this product, a product like this, what kind of features do you want? And what the brain hears is when you buy this from me, as in it's a command to buy this from me. Those kinds of things can be very powerful aspect of social engineering if used properly. I think the reason why NLP or NHR gets a bad rap in the security community at times is because it's difficult. And many people don't spend the time to master those things, but they can be used very effectively when it comes to the security world.
Mm. And I think they are used in sales, in advertisements, in many ways in our society. We are confronted with these techniques, and they're used on us without even noticing it. And but still, this is something which gives me always a kind of ethical question mark. How far can I go? And I think it's good to look into that and to educate oneself, also because then you can understand when these techniques are used on yourself. Often I see even people like Richard Bandler, who developed NLP and NHR, that, for example, he uses the phrase at the end of one of his recent DVDs, and by now you should have noticed, and
yes,
which is a command in his framework that you have to buy something now. There are many, many things and many techniques in this world, and one of them is reframing. And I heard you mentioning that in another podcast on social-engineer.org, and maybe you can give us some example how, for example, you reframe something when you make a phone call to a company that you're targeting.
Sure. I mean, to me, framing is a powerful aspect that doesn't necessarily originate with NLP, but definitely NLP has helped us to perfect the idea of how to use framing. And I think one of the power parts of NLP and framing, that when it was established for psychological reasons back in the 70s, was how a person can use reframing on themselves to make themselves rethink a different attitude about them. So, you know, you have someone who's very negative, depressed, maybe even hating life, wanting to end life, and the people who developed Bandler and Grinder, who developed NLP for the use of psychology, thought that they can reframe a person's thoughts by presenting words and ideas to them over and over and over again that would allow them to change their whole thinking. the thinking that they would have inside of them. And I think in a social engineering aspect, we do that by not being direct. You know, you don't come out and ask someone, hey, what's your password? You don't do that. You might profile first and then ask questions that would lead you to answers that would give them an idea about their password. Like like what we, I'm trying to think of what we did in DEF CON. You ask people questions about, you have a, it would be less direct than this, but the goal would be you find out if they have a family. You find out what kind of children they have, boys or girls, how many, the names of their children. And then when you get that kind of information from them, you're developing a profile that now would make it easier for them to trust you down the road, to give you more valuable information, but also tell you things that they might have used in their passwords. Also, how you make the sentences sound, how you make the information come out. One great example we give of this that's not security related at all, but it's used in grocery stores all the time, is you go to buy ground meat, and they say it's 80% lean. Well, what does that mean? People say it's 80% lean. That's good meat, right? We would buy it. But 80% lean means also that's 20% fat. Now, what if they just put that on that package? If they put that on the meat package saying 20% fat meat, you know, no one would buy it. No one would buy it because it sounds horrible. And that's the aspect of framing, I think, that's powerful in security, is how you word things. So you don't come out and say, this is a horrible part of your security package. This is the, you need to do this, you need to do that. You talk about the positives of what your goal is, and then that encourages people to open up and talk more. And getting people to talk about themselves also is a great way to use framing and how you work your or frame your questions in order to get people to talk more openly. And you get them talking about them, many times you'll get a lot of information, things that you didn't even ask for.
There was one guy on your show, on the podcast, Joe Navarro, who also talked about the subject of non-verbals and how you could use those to read other people's character, how you can make guesses out of their the way they move or things like that.
Yeah.
And this also sounds very powerful to me. I mean, he is a former FBI agent and used this for interrogation, or
he did. Yeah, as a matter of fact, both framing and nonverbals are used heavily in interrogation and interview techniques. Actually, he hated the word interrogation. He liked to use the word interview. He said interrogation sounds so abrupt and in your face, whereas interview is something like what you and I are doing. We're having a conversation, and you're easily eliciting information out of me because I'm viewing this as an interview, not an interrogation. But if you said, hey, Chris, I want to call you and interrogate you for an hour for our podcast, I would be a lot less forthcoming with information.
So, I have to try that.
Should try it with someone. But that also, to answer your previous question, is a great example of framing. See, to me, there's four or five rules when it comes to framing and social engineering. Four rules that I always promote. I wanted to think if it was four or five, I broke it down into four. And at least when it comes to security and SE, to me, I think the thing that we have to remember is that everything we say will invoke a frame. So everything, our brain thinks in pictures. So every word we use, every time we describe something, it's going to invoke someone to a thought. They're going to think about a picture. They're going to start painting that picture in their mind. So, you know, just telling someone like what you ate for dinner, they're going to be, if they've had it before, they're going to picture it in their mind. So the more you allow the person to picture in their mind, then the more the idea becomes theirs. And that really ties in with the second rule, which is that words are that are defined within a frame, they invoke another frame in the mind. So you don't have to use the exact words. Like, I don't have to tell you that I saw a spider. I can say, man, I saw this insect inside of a web eating another insect. And automatically, I've invoked inside your mind the picture of a spider. Because I've created that picture inside of your head, and that's framing. Or using something like negating the frame. Like if I tell you, don't picture a spider. Whatever you do, don't picture it. you have to picture a spider. You have to think about a spider in order to not think about it. That's kind of a really funny aspect of framing. And then anytime you cause a target to think about a frame, you reinforce it. So this could be used heavily in security. Now, Joe, when he was on the podcast, he talked about nonverbals. He said what's great about using nonverbals is that when you invoke a frame, when you make a person think about something, what that automatically does is trigger an emotional response. So, like one guy who I work, one doctor I work very closely with, I write about him a lot in the book, is Dr. Paul Ekman. He's like the granddaddy of microexpressions. You know, he created the science behind microexpressions in the world, in the science world today. And that's just looking at someone's face and the belief of microexpressions, which has been proven true over the years, is that emotions will create muscular responses. Now, not macro expressions, not the expression you show on your face for a lengthy period of time, but a micro expression being like 25th of a second. So if someone makes you think about someone that you don't like, then even though you might try to put a fake smile on, your initial muscular response in your face will show disgust or contempt or anger. And those things can be read by people who have been trained to read them. Someone like Joe or Paul Ekman, these people have been trained to read them. And when you can see that micro expression by invoking a frame, and you invoke an emotion, and now you can learn about what a person either likes or dislikes, or if you're doing good or bad in your social engineering efforts, by being able to use nonverbal cues to read their facial expressions, their body language, and things like that to know really how you can further influence them. I think, tell us the truth, if you analyze heavily, if you were to be able to get video of social engineering efforts, that you would see this, and clear as day. There was actually one case. I don't want to dominate the convo here, but let me just tell you this one, because this is really interesting on this topic. There was this one case where we were called in by a bank that had an account compromised. And the way the woman did it is she and her husband were getting a divorce. Husband was a jerk. She wanted to access accounts to find out, not to steal all of his money, but to find out where his money was being spent. They had separate accounts in the same bank. And she wanted to find out if he was spending his money on, you know, girls and hotels and other things. And she didn't have right to access that account. She was an attractive woman, you know, middle-aged, so she dressed a little provocative, went into the bank, acted like she was filling out some slips, and waited for a teller line to open that had a younger male in the line. And, you know, her shirt was low-cut. This was all captured on video, so you got to see it firsthand, this social engineering attack. And she goes up to the teller window, and she leans over, you know, maybe exposing herself a little bit, seductive, and cries. Now, of course, as any male helping a female, we're automatically going to need to come to the rescue. That's our general inherent ability as men, is to rescue women, right? And, you know, what's wrong? Why are you crying? My husband was in a terrible accident, and he's laid up in the hospital, and he's been there for 5 or 6 days, and we've wiped out our complete savings account. And he told me when he was out, he's in and out of consciousness, and last time he woke up, he told me that he has some money in this account here, the same bank I have my account, but I just tried to withdraw some money, and I don't have access to the account. I don't want to take the money out. I don't want it. All I need to do is have a printout of our account so I can take it to the hospital and show them that that we have money so that they don't kick him out and that he can continue to get the care that he needs. And the guy fell for it, printed out a whole bank record, handed it to her. She walks out of the hospital, sees where he's spending the money. She takes it to her lawyers. They get a divorce. She gets a huge settlement because she was able to use all these aspects. And seeing it on video, you can see how nonverbals really worked on this guy. I mean, he wasn't looking at her face. He was looking down her shirt. He was focused on the fact she was crying. He wanted to help her. You know, it was just a whole big aspect of this attack that really worked perfectly on this guy. And, you know, it's sad because he breached bank protocol, but at the same time, it was really interesting to see that in action.
Mm. So, Logan, we are already over time, but I would still like to ask you a final question about, do you know some scientific connections between your fields. You mentioned some studies which were made which helped you to get data for what you're doing, but have there been any research on social engineering, or do you draw from other research fields to develop the subject you're working in?
Yes. Yes to the second part. No, I don't know of any formal scientific studies into social engineering, but what I've done, and I think the book is probably more useful for this than anything else, is any time I've used scientific or medical research to back up a point about human behavior, I've referenced the research paper in the book, and usually downloaded the paper and given a PDF so people can download it and read it for themselves, or referenced where that study comes from. Even if it's something as simple as like social proof, like why sitcoms will use canned laughter as opposed to nothing. You know, there's been a study on that, and in the book I have the reference to that article of where that study was done and how it's provable. So I don't know of any formal social engineering scientific studies, maybe that were just focused on social engineering, but many times the research that was done in a science field we've used to write the book or to figure out different aspects of human behavior and then reference those works in the book or on the website too. I have a lot of them.
So, and I think now you probably just gave us the best advertisement for your book without even intending it.
I guess too, if that's what you like, because to me, I think maybe I'm similar to you guys in your group and your field, is that when I read something, and it's not something original, it's not something I've come up with, what I like to always see is the reference work for it. Because you might read the same reference article and get something different from it or something deeper. So a lot of these studies that were done, some of the ones that I use in the book, especially when it came to influence, persuasion, nonverbals, microexpressions, they're pages long. You know, some of them could be 20, 30, 80 pages. So you read through these studies over the years, and I've developed some of this research. It's pretty hefty. You know, you have to be able to analyze it for yourself, though, and look through it and see why these things apply and how they work. So I think that's something we've tried to do.
Yeah, I heavily thank you for having you on the show. It was a pleasure. And I learned a lot, and hopefully my audience as well. And yeah, we will link to all the things we mentioned in this podcast. And yeah, thank you, Logan.
Thank you very much.